You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Rachel Den Hollander became well-known in recent years as the leader of a group of sister survivors, the many women and girls who were sexually abused by sports doctor Larry Nassar.
Rachel Den Hollander, R-A-C-H-A-E-L.
Den Hollander was the first person to tell her story on the record about the abuse she suffered and the institutions where Nassar worked, including USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University. During her victim impact statement at Nassar's sentencing, she spoke about the result of a culture that protects abusers.
This is what it looks like. It looks like a courtroom full of survivors who carry deep wounds. Women and girls who have banded together to fight for themselves because no one else would do it.
Den Hollander has a new memoir out, What is a Girl Worth? My story of breaking the silence and exposing the truth about Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics. And she joins us now. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we dive into the book, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on right now. A couple of weeks ago, a group of sister survivors met with the new president of Michigan State University, Samuel Stanley, and they say that they left disappointed. One parent even said that it was more of the same from MSU. Where do things stand from your perspective with Michigan State and the sister survivors?
Yeah, I would echo that deep disappointment. MSU has yet to publicly identify a single failure that was made. They have yet to point to one time an employee didn't report Larry and say, this is not okay. We have been asking for 3 years for a comprehensive review of what happened, one that is able to obtain all of the facts and put out a public report. And that has yet to be done. We've had reviews done in specific departments that were forced by the Department of Education and other enforcement, but we've never had a comprehensive review done. And I actually spent the last 8 months, three of my sister survivors, and I spent the last 8 months working with the board, and we had put together exactly what MSU needed and what we've been asking for the last 3 years. And then we had four board members stall it, and unfortunately, President Stanley wouldn't step in to say anything.
Have you spoken with him before, now that he's in this new role? Have you met with him or spoken with him?
I have not. I was not able to meet to make any of those meetings. Of course, I'm out of state, and I'm more than happy to. I would love the opportunity to sit down, but that has not happened. The offer has not been made.
How do you make heads or tails of this? What do you ascribe to how the university has been interacting with the whole group of survivors from the very beginning till now?
It started off with a very antagonistic tone, a tone of more concern for liability, more concern for their reputation than there was for the safety of little girls and the safety of students. And I think it's important to note that, as we have been saying for the last 3 years, this is not a Larry Nassar problem. This is a cultural problem. This is a problem at MSU. We have multiple instances where the Title IX office or employees at MSU failed to report abuse. But there are breakdowns in the Title IX process and on MSU's campus all the time. And what are we going to do about those survivors whose voices aren't heard? Who don't have the media pressure, who can, extract all this information with FOIA reports, because there are hundreds of survivors on MSU's campus who are still not seen and who are still not heard. And that's the entire point of the advocacy we've been doing over the last 3 years is, look, you need to root out these problems because you're leaving all of your students at risk. You're leaving everyone on your campus at risk if you haven't identified exactly what went wrong. And MSU has refused to do that. They have still refused to waive attorney-client privilege, even for law enforcement investigations. So they are withholding thousands of documents from the Attorney General as she is trying to investigate what went wrong from a legal standpoint at MSU. They're refusing to turn over that information. When the Attorney General's investigation started, they sent a deluge of useless information, like the bed bug policy in dorm rooms, and coupons, and all kinds of extraneous information to bury what they did turn over. So it's been a complete culture of noncompliance and silencing survivors, and refusing to admit what went wrong right from day one.
What would you say is the culture that is preventing things from moving forward in a way that identifies these issues and can root them out?
Yeah, I think what we are really seeing here, and what we see every time, is we see the cultural problems that we have across the country in every sector blown up and put under a microscope. And so you really see two factors at MSU. You have a contingent that realizes they have a problem, but they're so afraid of liability and they value money so much that they are unwilling to do the right thing. They prioritize money over the safety of people. And then you have another contingent that has simply fallen prey to rape myths and abusive culture, and they really don't see the problem. They don't understand why it's such a big deal. And both facets are deeply troubling. Both facets leave everyone on campus unsafe. But those are not dynamics unique to MSU. You have those same dynamics playing out across the country in other universities, in athletic departments, in national governing bodies for Olympic associations, in religious institutions, and just in communities where abusers are allowed to flourish. There is a consistent pattern in this country of either looking at abuse and saying, not a big deal. Why does it matter? Why aren't you over it? Or a pattern of saying, well, that's bad, but money is worth more. Because ultimately, that's what we do. We pull out a scale. Every time we make a decision, we pull out a scale. And on one side, we put people. And on the other side, we put our competing interests, the money or the liability that we're afraid of. And we decide which one matters more. MSU is consistently deciding that money matters more. But that's not unique to MSU.
You worked with then-Senator Margaret O'Brien on a package of bills that would have and did change Michigan law around mm-hmm. sexual assault statute of limitations. Those bills were passed, but there was a series of bills that were included in that package that did not get a vote or did not make it all the way through the legislature. So at least a lot left to be desired, mm-hmm. including the ability to sue institutions like Michigan State. Tell me a little bit about how you felt about the outcome of those bills.
You know, the honest reality is the House of Representatives slapped us in the face. That's the truth. Because that package of bills, the 10 bills that I worked on with Senator O'Brien, that we had overwhelming bipartisan support for in the Senate, were designed to bring Michigan up out of being almost the worst in the country on many provisions of sexual assault justice, really to just kind of in the middle. You know, we were not proposing something that was radical by any stretch of the imagination. But the main provisions of that package really were gutted by the House of Representatives. And they did exactly what we asked them not to do, which was to create a very narrowly tailored provision that applied only to Nassar survivors. And I sat in that House of Representatives and I begged them not to do it. And I said, this is not about us. This is about every survivor that you're not seeing, who doesn't have media pressure, who doesn't have a sisterhood, who's never going to see justice because you have closed off the doors of the courtroom to them with an archaic statute of limitations. Don't you dare make this about us. This is about everybody you're not seeing. And they did exactly what we asked them not to do.
So it sounds like you're not satisfied with the outcome of any of what was voted on, essentially.
The vast majority of it, no, because what we were going for really did get gutted. There are a few things that were done great. The other acts, there's a particular statutory provision for evidence law that was passed that was excellent. And I was very grateful to see that through because that had been stalled for about 3 years in committee. And we were able to get that through. But the vast majority of what needed to be done ultimately did not get done. And it did not get done because of caving to special interest groups.
Why did you want to write this book, Rachel?
Oh, so many reasons. You know, the honest truth is I didn't really want to write it because it was a very difficult process. And having it out there is just one more level of exposure. So for a long time, I said, it's not happening. I'm not going to do that. But it got to the point where I looked at what had happened with the Nassar investigation. And just the weight of realizing how many other survivors' voices are not heard and are never going to be heard because they don't have hundreds coming forward and they don't have, you know, media pressure and they don't have those dynamics that we had, but their cases are every bit as important, you know. And so it got to the point where I said the difficulty of writing it is going to be outweighed by the benefit that I hope will come from it. Because really, you know, most people tuned in to the Nassar investigation all the way at the end. When Larry was this gaunt figure in an orange jumpsuit sitting in a courtroom and he couldn't lift his eyes. But that's not who Larry had been a year earlier. And those are not the dynamics that we faced when we came forward. And what people don't understand is what it took to get to that place. Everything that we faced, that I faced, to wrest control from the organizations that were shielding Larry. The breakdowns, the multiple breakdowns with law enforcement that was shielding Larry or botching investigations, the authority figures, the culture, the community, and just what an incredible uphill battle it was to get to that moment and how unusual it is to get to that moment. And so the first thing I really wanted to do is lift the veil on all of that and to show what it really took so that people understand and they hear the voices of other survivors coming out and they can look at my story and they can say, if it was that difficult for a white middle-class woman who's an educated attorney, imagine how much more so it is for a survivor from a minority or an impoverished community, or who doesn't have family support, or who doesn't have a detective and a prosecutor who are passionate about the truth. because we need people to speak for those survivors.
Rachel, I'm hoping that I can get you to read a passage for me from your book.
Sure.
This passage mm-hmm. takes place. You've just finished watching the girls in 1996 in Atlanta just take the world by storm at the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. I can. The emotion of the moment was palpable. These little girls with perfect bodies had done what no other U.S. women's gymnastics team had ever done. They'd paid a high price, including the injury of a teammate, and still they had persisted. It was incredible. And it reminded me of how much I loved that sport. I'd taken a gymnastics class once when I was little, and I had been in awe of it ever since. I didn't remember much, except how bad the foam pit smelled and how much I'd wanted to continue but couldn't. It was just too expensive. I was 11 and a half now, years too late to be a serious gymnast, but I still wanted back in the gym. Everything about it amazed me. I loved the combination of mental and physical acuity the sport required, the level of perfection and amount of repetition needed to make every move flawless and beautiful. I marveled at the gymnasts' physical strength and flexibility, as well as their diligence and determination. I loved that you couldn't do this sport halfway or pick it up casually. I was a perfectionist, and I wanted a sport that demanded this from me.
So I love that passage, first of all, because I remember feeling very strongly in 1996 as well. And now you want back into the sport and you realize that the sport calls to you because of what it calls in your character. Well, you apply that standard to gymnastics, but you also write about it in similar terms when it comes to religion and repentance, mm-hmm. as well as justice within the law along similar lines. So how does this need for a structure that strives towards perfection work in your life?
You know, I think at the essence, that's something all of us feel. All of us know that there is right and wrong, that there are certain things that are absolutely inexcusable, that are not okay in any circumstance. Sexual abuse is one of them. Sexual abuse is never okay. And so all of us have this intrinsic desire and need for justice because we know that certain things are always wrong. And when you really look at what we are doing, every little decision that we make, you know, ultimately we are stripping it down to a decision of right and wrong, a decision of cost and benefit. And so that's something I try to do every time I am faced with a decision, is to go, what am I really balancing here? You know, and strip it down to the essence of that decision.
Well, you spend some time talking about abuse of coaches in the world of gymnastics and the psychological toll it obviously takes on young girls, and not sexually abusive necessarily, but mm-hmm. emotionally, even physically in some ways. How did that experience within that world of gymnastics allow you to see abusive leadership in other areas of your life, like perhaps in the church or at Michigan State or even with Larry Nassar?
Yeah, it is a rampant problem in the world of gymnastics and in many, many athletic organizations. I was very fortunate that the gym I was at was not abusive. I had a very positive experience with all of my coaches. And that really provided me with an excellent contrast to those abusive coaching methods, to be able to look at it and say, you know what, you don't have to break little girls to raise champions. You don't have to prioritize money and medals over people. And to understand that the greatest motivator anyone has is to be motivated by love, to know that they are safe, to feel safe with their coaches, and to be motivated by love of the sport and joy of doing it with their teammates and with their coach. That's how you raise healthy athletes who pour themselves into the sport in a way that is constructive instead of destructive. And so I was very fortunate to have that contrast, but many athletes can't say that. Gymnastics is a very abusive sport, and you know it is not just the sexual abuse that is rampant in the organization, but it is, as you said, the physical and the verbal abuse and the emotional abuse, where you are taking little children who are dependent on their coaches and on their gym environment for safety. And those little girls know that they're dependent on their coach for safety. And they are just torn down at every chance they get. And again, ultimately, the reason for that is because we think it works.
Well, and in some ways it does work, right? I mean,
mm-hmm, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is an element to which you can make someone so afraid of messing up, so afraid of the fallout and the abuse that comes from messing up, so afraid of losing their identity and their value because you've tied up their identity and their value into their success, their athletic success, that they will work incredibly hard because they're dependent on it. But what that does is creates an extreme dysfunction in the individual. But a lot of leaders don't really care about that. Because again, they're pulling out that scale, and on one side, they're putting money and medals and the reputation of the organization. On the other side, they're putting little girls who pay the price, and they're deciding that money and medals matter more.
Rachel, you've used the term little girls several times in this conversation, and you use it throughout the book as well. And, you know, I think I understand what you mean, but you're also using it sort of across the board, whether you're talking about a six-year-old girl who's just starting gymnastics or a 20-year-old young woman who is in college. Why do you use that term across the board when you're talking about these affected women and girls?
Well, part of the reason is because for the most part, most of us were little girls when this happened. I was more on the upper age of the spectrum, being 15, and I was still a child. But most of us were little girls. And particularly when you're dealing with the world of gymnastics, you're dealing with little girls. And that's something that very easily gets lost, because these athletes, you know, when they become elite, they are the top. They are the best of the best athletes in the world. And it's easy to lose sight of the fact that they are children, and we are doing this to children. And I think that's something USAG needs to be more honest about, even to themselves. You know, several Olympic athletes have come out talking about how much they were starved at the Corrales Ranch, how their gym bags would be searched for food and they were deprived of food, to the point that sometimes they would have to go around in hotels and they would have to look for leftover room service that had been put out in the hallway because they were literally starving. Yeah, and we need to realize those were little girls. You know, when you've got little girls going to the Corrales Ranch, some of those kids were as young as 9 and 10 years old.
Right.
You're searching a 10-year-old's gym bag to make sure she doesn't have a granola bar. You're starving a child. And we need to put it in those terms. We need to stop letting these athletic organizations hide behind the mature athletic ability that these kids have. And we need to look at what they're really doing. No, you're starving a child. You're abusing a child. And abuse is horrific in any form. And so I don't mean that to mitigate abuse of older women, because it is evil in any form. But we need to be honest about what's really going on. And we need to not allow organizations to reframe the issue by doing things to make it look like it's more acceptable, or like there is, like these children have more ability to defend themselves than they do. They're children.
Well, it's sort of almost like an out-of-body experience, I want to say. I would imagine that looking at a situation that happened to you as a girl, now as a woman, and a mother, and a daughter, and all of those things, it would probably, on one hand, make you feel like you still were that little girl, you still are that little girl that this happened to, but also that I would be infuriated for that little girl, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate way of saying it. And that's something that I really always see in front of me. You know, again, with the Nassar sentencing hearing, most people saw women standing up because most of us, not all of us, but most of us were grown, you know, and had become women. But we were all little girls, and many of them were very, very young. And that's what I see in front of me all the time. You know, I see the incredibly powerful women that they have become, but I see the little girls that they were when they were left defenseless and they were left at the mercy of a predator because the adults didn't want to do the right thing.
I'm speaking now with Rachel Denhollander. She wrote a book, What is a Girl Worth? My story of breaking the silence and exposing the truth about Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics. I want to talk about the relationship with your mother. You write a lot about the relationship with your mom. You clearly have a deep, abiding love and respect for her and for the guidance she provided you as you were growing up. But now that you're a mother as well, how has it affected the parenting and guidance that you received from your mom as you navigated that crisis with Larry? How do you think about it in terms now as a mom, as yourself?
Honestly, it has made me realize all the more how incredibly unusual my parents were and how difficult it was and would have been to go through what they went through. Because being a mom now, I understand so much better even the depth of love that a good parent has for their child and just that incredible desire to keep them safe and to protect them and the horrific reality that you can do everything right. And I really do believe my parents did. I look back on what they did and how they did it, and there's nothing I would have had them do differently. They were very open with communication. I knew my mom was a survivor. We talked about abuse. We talked about bodily autonomy, privacy. You know, we talked about all those things very openly. I never had any fear that I wouldn't be able to speak up and have my parents believe me. And so I look back on that, and there's nothing really that I would have had my parents do differently.
Right.
And that's difficult for me to wrestle with as a mom, is to realize you can do it all right, and your kids can still end up very, very hurt. But it's also shown me the importance of being that safe place for your children to land. Because while my parents couldn't keep everything bad from happening to me, they gave me a safe place to heal. They gave me a safe place to speak up. And that is invaluable.
Well, with all that your mom had been through herself and being very conscious of wanting to protect you from abuse, and still you ran into Larry, how do you reconcile now protecting your own children with not keeping them in a bubble and making sure they still have a full life as you did?
Yeah, absolutely. I really go back to looking at a lot of what my parents did. They had a lot of very wise boundaries in place that did save me, I think, from further abuse and from abusive situations that I could have fallen into. For example, when I started gymnastics, and again, I talk about some of this in the book, but when I started gymnastics, my mom and I had a lot of conversations and continue to have conversations on what a healthy coaching style would look like, on boundaries for what a coach should or shouldn't do, including sexual boundaries. What sorts of things should a coach never ask you? What sorts of jokes should a coach never tell? How do you pay attention to how you're being spotted to make sure a coach is not taking advantage of a situation? We talked about all of those things. And my mom told me when I started, if I ever see a hint of an unhealthy coaching environment, you will be out of there so fast, you're not going to know what pulled you. And she said, and I know that might be hard. I know you might get angry if I take that step, but it is worth risking your anger to keep you safe. You are worth more than what you might accomplish in that sport. And so we had those conversations over and over and over again. I knew that my identity wasn't the gym because my parents taught me that. I knew where my value came from because my parents taught me that. And I knew that I was worth more than athletic achievement and that I would be protected if anything happened, even protected from myself.
Would you ever recommend to your kids that they do gymnastics if they were interested in it? I mean, it seems like there is a lot of you enjoyed the gym that you went to. You described
that,
right? You described this gym that's next to a Claire's, which I just thought was great.
Yeah.
But because you know how it can look at the elite level and even at the amateur level, the abuse that can go on in any sport that's taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. What would you say to your kids if they wanted to do gymnastics?
One of my daughters is actually asking. She's been begging for a year. And until USAG cleans up their act, I do not trust them with my child's safety. And I wish I could say differently. That being said, while there are certainly very distinct pitfalls within gymnastics, very distinct areas where the sport lends itself to predators, it can be done in a way that is just beautiful, that nurtures, that trains the character and the whole athlete in a way that benefits them for the rest of their lives, that teaches them, that uses sports to teach life lessons, that makes them a whole person and a better person. And that's what sports is supposed to be. And so I would love for my daughters and my son to be able to participate in that sport, if that's something that they desire, in a way that is healthy. That being said, right now, the organization is so full of corruption and just a complete refusal to see the problem and to do the right thing. I would never put my child under their authority right now and dependent on their safety. In my daughter's case, she's 5 years old and she wants to do the bars specifically. She loves that idea of flying around the bars and hanging upside down and flipping around. And there's nothing much comparable to that. So I would love for my kids to be able to participate in a healthy way in that sport. And I would love for USAG to do the right thing so that the children participating in that sport can know that they're safe and that they can progress through the ranks in a way that is healthy, where they're going to be protected and valued. But we're not there yet.
Well, Rachel, I want to end here. In your book, you're talking about what's going through your mind as you're reading your victim impact statement, and you sort of break it up into the different parts, distill it down to the different parts. Mm-hmm. But you say, as I began, the words of the abolitionist William Wilberforce ran through my mind, quote, "You may choose to look the other way, but you can never again say you did not know." So I'm curious what it is that you can never again say that you did not know.
You know, the honest truth is, from the last 3 years, I haven't had any surprises. And I almost wish I could say that I have, because, you know, for 16 years, I said, I can't do this without media pressure. I can't do this anonymously. There are people shielding this abuser. I cannot trust anybody. Somebody's going to have to take control from these organizations. And I wish I had been wrong. I wish I had been able to come forward and be immediately met with, what went wrong? How can we fix it? We're so sorry. We're going to do the right thing. But I wasn't. And I was right about the depth of the damage. I knew that there would be little girls walking into Larry's door who were not going to be safe, and that there was nothing I could do to stop it unless I had the ability to take control from those organizations, unless I had media pressure. And I wish I could look back and say I had been wrong, that something could have been done, that there weren't people shielding Larry, that the depth of the damage wasn't so great. But I was right every time. I was right. And that's the lesson that we need to take from this so that we do it better the next time.
Rachel Den Hollander, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having the conversation.
We reached out to Michigan State University with an opportunity to respond to Ms. Den Hollander's comments. We did not hear back.